marketing is going to be big consumers of AI. I think that's definitely true. But the difficulty that marketing's always had is that they've had a more complex data story. And it's because they have more data, but they also have it in more different forms. And they've also had it in different applications. So they've had a plumbing issue, marketing, we for years. And that's really what CDP was supposed to solve. And the issue is not, it's not marketers' faults. It was just what happened over time. They had to adapt to something which is very difficult to predict, which is customer behavior.
I'm Greg Stewart, CEO of MMA Global.
I'm Rex Briggs, an author, marketing researcher, entrepreneur, and chief AI officer at Claritas. And this is Decoding AI for Marketing.
So Rex, listen, I've said this a bunch and I'll say it again here, I guess. You know, listen, marketing is probably the area that's going to be changed the most rapidly because of AI. I think you and I have known that. I think we both also know that there's a lot of inefficiency in marketing that really could be improved upon. But listen, an interesting reason behind that and beyond kind of what we've talked about in past episodes might be that just AI runs on data, right? Marketers often have more data on users than any other part of the organization. And, you know, we would hope that they really truly understand customers, right?
Yeah, and Salesforce, the company where our guest works on strategy, is a great example of that. The Salesforce Customer Data Platform, or CDP, for those of you who love acronyms, has been around for a handful of years and is having a huge impact on all kinds of experiences. And the company's shift to focusing on the data cloud across functions happened over time, starting with marketers who were the original customers because they had so much data. And really thinking about salespeople, they had a need to track each of the conversations and engagements they were having, which automatically generates data.
We're going to talk about data, AI for enterprise, and much more with today's guest, Marty Kine. He's Senior Vice President, Strategy at Salesforce, now focusing on their data cloud. Marty, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me on the show.
So Marty, your role at Salesforce has evolved as the tech has changed. Tell us a little bit more about what you're doing with data, what you're most excited about. And I definitely want you to touch on a little bit about the trust layer and how that's working, because that's a really important concept for people to understand.
I started 2018. I was at Gartner before that for 5 years. And at the end of my time at Gartner, I was covering this new category called Customer Data Platform, CDP, among other things. And the most common question I got as an analyst, and we kept track of the questions, was, what is this thing called a CDP? I mean, it was at that level. And that was, you know, only 6 years ago, I guess, 5.5 years ago. So CDP has evolved a lot. I knew it was important then. And I joined Salesforce to look into CDP as a category. It wasn't clear at that time whether it was substantially different from CRM, because the C in CDP and the C in CRM are customer. CRM does have a sort of unified customer profile to a certain extent. So it wasn't clear what the boundaries were. And in fact, the category CDP didn't have clear boundaries. Now we have the CDP Institute. We have a definition. We have RFIs that go out that are pretty consistent. So it's very different today. But at that time, it wasn't. So we did an exercise at Salesforce, you know, build by partner. And the decision was made to build. Mostly, this was made by our former co-CEO, Brett Taylor, who is a technical genius. And he said, this is so close to the core of the enterprise, the CDP, that it needs to be built on the same platform as CRM. If we acquired a company, it would be too difficult to bolt it on. If we partnered, it would be kind of a mess. So we decided to build, and that made it longer. It took longer to get to market. 5 years ago, 6 years ago, we started building and released 3 years ago. So that was the first version. And that was Customer Data Platform, Salesforce CDP, as you mentioned. And that has evolved to today, which is now called Data Cloud. The only difference between CDP and Data Cloud is, I think the buyer profile is different. It's more expansive. CDP is primarily as a category used by marketers. That's changing, but in general, marketers use it. Today, the idea of Data Cloud is it's enterprise-wide. It's customer experience from end to end. You know, through the call center, through loyalty, through commerce, and it's all the same customer. So it really should be all the same kind of data and the same technology going through it. And then finally, the point around AI is key. I mean, that has exploded in the last year and a half, although AI, as you well know, Rex, is not new. And in fact, machine learning has been embedded in products for years. But these large language models are definitely new. And in fact, they existed before GPT came along, GPT-3. There was a GPT-2 and a GPT-1.
Yeah, and BERT.
BERT, exactly. Hugging Face existed. There were all these open source models. And in terms of the evolution of AI, I was studying data science. This was before GPT-3. So I was interested in generative AI before GPT-3. And my instructor was like, it doesn't work. Don't even bother. Generative AI is a joke. So there were all these things at the time, like Markov chains were used and long short-term memory and various things that took a lot of power. And then the output was basically you're trying to predict the next word. So it'd be like you have a word and you predict the next word. And it sometimes they'd look at a number of words in a row. But what came out was not really a coherent paragraph. It was words that kind of seemed like they fit together. So that's literally the level. And I tried GPT-2 and I tried to get it to write a plot for a Hallmark Christmas movie because I thought that is very formulaic. And if any generative AI could do that, they could pull it off. Didn't do a good job. But if you ask GPT-3 to do that, it's extremely good. So the jump between 2 and 3 was exponential. And I think we all saw that when ChatGPT came out.
For the listeners, I'm kind of curious, what did they figure out? I mean, listen, you Rex probably understands it, but I'm the non-tech guy here. What did they figure out between 2 and 3 that made that leap?
Well, there was a technical insight called transformers. GPT is built on transformers, and it's related to convolutional neural networks, and there's a lot of math, and so I'm probably not the best guy to explain it, but it was done by a guy in Toronto, and he had this insight. It was like, attention is all you need, so it's related to attention, but the basic idea is you have text, which is just patterns. How can you recognize what the patterns are at higher and higher levels of abstraction? So when we talk, we don't just think of, you know, I said a word and then I think of the next word. I'm thinking in a context of all that I've said before and all I know about the topic and who I'm talking to and what the context is. And so all of that can be embedded in these models, but only if you have massive amounts of data and massive computing power. So the real leap, I think, was in basically the infrastructure and the amount of money that was put into training these models and the scale. But also there was that technical insight, which maybe Rex can explain better than me.
No, you did a nice job. But if people want to read more, the paper is Attention is All You Need, and you can easily find that on the internet. But that was the big breakthrough. We'll talk a little bit more about the trust layer, because I think that that's a very important part of how all this comes together, because you have access to a tremendous amount of data. The question I had before, my uses of Salesforce in the past was that you had a lot of data, but you gave people a lot of freedom for how they wanted to categorize it, what labels they put it in. So you didn't have like a controlled vocabulary or taxonomy, but you did have multi-tenant framework that almost kept all people's data separate. So I was wondering like how you're going to make that leap to AI to where you need to learn across different data sets and so forth. I think you have the solution with the trust layer, right?
Yeah, there's a lot going on. I mean, we had to react to large language models, and the question is how to incorporate it into products. That's a big question. I think even before that, in terms of the data cloud, the insight there was around customer data platform, which is highly related to what you were saying. Salesforce CRM, so listeners who don't know, founded 20 years ago, Sales Cloud started, then it was Service Cloud. So it's customer relationship management, contact centers, tools for salespeople. It was relational databases. It's structured data, you know, highly structured data for the most part. I mean, there are call center transcripts that we started to look at and so on. But the CDP appeared, and the whole point of a CDP is that you can bring in data from outside other vendors. It can be, you know, transactional data. It can be analytical data. It can be in all kinds of forms. It can be unstructured. It can be structured. Then put it in a lake. Data cloud is built on a data lake or a lake house, more technically. So it literally, you do land raw data in any form into it. And that was new. I mean, that was net new when we launched our customer data platform. There's also something called Hyperforce underneath it, which is a multi-substrate kind of infrastructure for putting this lakehouse on top of it. But that's kind of another project that has been evolved over the years at Salesforce. But this lakehouse exists, and we needed that. And what that changed is then the introduction of the ability to handle data in different formats is unstructured, essentially. So it's big data, it's raw data, and it is conformed to a data model in the data cloud. So the way we think of AI in our products is there's three layers to AI. There's the data layer, which is data cloud. Then there's the model. So the modeling that's put on top of the data. And then there's the UI on top. So the UI is the thing literally that someone will log into in the morning. And we want that to be Salesforce, obviously. The data layer would be data cloud. And then the model in the middle, we realize, can take different forms. And it can be the customer's choice. But the real challenge that we had, and this was last summer, I remember I was sitting around with a bunch of CMOs, and I was saying, how do you feel about generative AI? And they were excited. But then I'm like, well, are you going to start using it? And they were like, no, we're scared of this. we don't know what's going to come out the other end. I can't just push a button and, you know, have a computer write notes to my customers. So we realized there was a need for guardrails around these models. So the models do sit out, you know, there are different versions. We have a large language model that Salesforce trained, but there's also OpenAI, there's also Anthropic, there's also Cohere. Google has one, Amazon has one. We don't want to pick a model, you know, we're not going to, but these are external models and the weights have been developed, billions of data points and trillions of data points, and they've been developed externally. And we want to be able to use that. But how can you make use of an external model for your corporate needs, whether it be marketing or the call center or, you know, commerce, product recommendations? And the answer is that you need very strict guardrails. And that's why we have this thing called the trust layer. And it has components to it. The obvious ones are, you know, detecting toxicity in the output, detecting bias in the data or the output. Your data can be very biased. But the most important one to me is what we call grounding. And that is taking the model and retraining it, conditioning it based on first-party data, based on your own data. And the reason to do that, you know, the simple example in marketing is when I send a corporate email out, sales email, promotion, whatever, it sounds like my brand. You know, I have probably a whole agency just focusing on what does my brand sound like. And I can't just have a model write unless they know what my brand sounds like. And the only way to do that is to train it on your own data. So that's a simple example, but we had to make it possible to do that. And that's what the trust layer is all about. It's kind of mediating this external models and then the internal use of the models.
Hey, Marty, I'm kind of curious, how would they make the decision on some of these different models if they were forced to do that? What's the process? Bring it back to marketers or business at large, if you want.
I mean, we have different architectures. So one is, it's called trusted and shared. So we have an arrangement with OpenAI. They seem to be the most popular, the most mature, and it's API access. And we have a deal where it's zero, we call it zero retention. So the arrangement is that no data will leak out. It won't be used to retrain GPT-5 or whatever. So that is basically API. So it's like you have your own data sitting over here, the model sitting over here, and you're kind of pinging back and forth. And it's trusted and shared. You can also have a model hosted in our environment because these external models are hosted elsewhere. You can have basically a per-tenant model. And that's Salesforce hosted. And that can be a Salesforce large language model, as I said. It could be Anthropic or DeepMind or, you know, one of these others. That's kind of self-hosted. That would be more if someone's not comfortable maybe with trusted and shared for whatever reason, or they have especially sensitive data and they have kind of legal reasons not to want to send it anywhere through an API. That could happen. And then there's also an idea of bringing your own model, which is you have a data science team and they're basically building their own. These would be mostly predictive models, not large language models, but they could be mini versions of large language models. And you can build it externally and then just import the model into your data. There's a way to do that. And then there's also bring your own large language model. So some companies now are exploring training their own versions of these. And they're not as resource intensive as they used to be. And that keeps changing all the time. So it becomes easier and easier to actually build your own large language model. And we foresee a time when enterprises might, you know, have their own versions or flavors of it. And we're already seeing this in, you know, real estate, in healthcare. There are healthcare focused LLMs, Arkify in finance, Nabla. I've heard about a few luxury presence in real estate.
But are marketers or CMOs going to have to be making their own decision on models someday? I mean, that feels a little beyond the scope of where marketers go right now. That's what I'm asking.
Oh, how do they decide? It'll be, in terms of the technical details, that's always left to the experts. You know, the data science team or whoever. But I do think that the output is what matters. It's sort of the use case and the output. And they'll be able to test the different versions. They'll say, let's try this. We'll try this. And do we feel more comfortable with this, you know, this workflow or this model or this price, frankly? It's like any other technology decision, I would say.
We just went through an example like that with one of the CAP studies, Greg, with MMA Global, where we're using Gen AI to create ads for the marketer. And they're scripts. They start as scripts and then they have synthetic voices and synthetic music. And initially, the company wasn't comfortable with the data being from one of the more advanced services. And so we said, okay, well, we'll start off by turning on Meta's open source Llama model. It's kind of like GPT-3. But it's definitely not GPT-4. And so after they, you know, tried that for a week, they're like, hey, can we try the 4 one again? And an hour later, like, oh, this is so much better. We're so excited about this. But it's a lot more expensive, right? I mean, you know, you pay a lot more per token, but you get more power. So there are all these trade-offs of, you know, if you have a trust layer, are you comfortable with that alone? Yeah. So I think it's great that you're giving people choice in terms of how they approach it and make it really flexible. Mm-hmm. What are some of the main workflows that you're seeing people build with these, like the big wins that you're seeing marketers have when they turn these on?
Well, we have the Copilot, which is, I mean, it's what you think it is. It's sort of, it's sitting there, it's a little assistant. And what we realize there is that in order for large language models, AI, to be useful to, you know, B2B software users, so people who log into our products and other products, they have to be in the flow of work. So they have to be kind of incorporated into what people are doing every day. And it would vary by your function. But we do have a list of use cases that keep coming up over and over again. In marketing, it is like write subject lines for emails so I can test them, you know, give me suggestions for subject lines that, you know, might work based on what has worked in the past. And then also body copy and imagery. So content generation in a very controlled world. Email is a very good place to start. You can also do it with text. You can do it with website copy for SEO. And then on the commerce side, product descriptions are a very kind of low-hanging fruit. Very, very useful use of LLMs. They are great at churning out 100,000 SKUs of product descriptions, where if you went to your creative team and said, give me 100,000 descriptions, their eyes would fall out of their head and they would quit. And then on the call center side, you know, doing summaries of calls, like these models are very good at summaries, summarizing interactions and then doing suggested next steps. We have examples of when a call center agent is on the phone with somebody and they're resolving a call, you know, the Copilot can suggest topics of conversation that could maybe lead them to an upsell or a cross-sell. And that worked, but we had a customer, Gucci, who was one of our early adopters, and they had a call center, you know, they had a model built that was Gucci-fied, so it would Gucci-fy the voice. So they actually had sentences written out for the call center agent to read or, you know, to paraphrase that sounded like their kind of the luxury voice. And even if you were a new call center agent, you would end up sounding like Gucci and make it more likely to retain that customer. So there are common use cases depending on the user, you know, the different personas.
Can you do a little Gucci-fied voice for us? I'm just curious.
I can't. And it's in an Italian accent. My accents are not so good, but it's very luxury, though. Very luxury.
Yeah, very. Yeah. I think you're right. You just extend all the words.
Oh, yes.
Like you're speaking richly, I think, is what you just said.
Yeah, you want to give just the right tone to it all.
And by the way, just when you say that, so the direction from some of this is, just so I'm clear on the Gucci one, is this showing up in the, just in the copy that's being used in text? Or you're talking, you're actually changing the service center's voices, audio?
No, not yet. No, and it's not synthetic voice. It's the call center agent, the way the agents operate, and you know, it's different in different companies, but they'll call up a screen and they'll have, usually when they're talking to someone, they'll have that record in front of them and it's dynamic. So it'll show, you know, previous cases. It might even show marketing interactions. It'll show customer lifetime value. And then there'll be an interactive screen with like suggestions for a cross-sell and upsell. So they're reading off a screen as they go along. And also some of them, you know, will detect tone of voice and how angry is this person and that kind of thing. I mean, it is customer experience, and I think that's where it's going. It's not siloed. It's not marketing, it's service and commerce are three different teams and three different countries and three different databases. It should be, you know, tightly linked.
Well, Marty, you probably wouldn't know this, but listen, the MMA has done a lot of work around three core marketing strategies out there. There's brand, there's transactional like DTC, and customer experience is a third. There's only three marketing strategies and told they can be combinations and everything. But the analysis that the professors we've worked with have done has said that the companies with the best financial performance are those who make customer experience their primary marketing strategy. Mm. So regression analysis that they've done over a massive data set to sort of assess that's best. I mean, I think if you ask a lot of marketers, they think brand is number one, but that's actually not the case.
No, I'm sure you're right. I was just at last week, the Dentsu Summit, they have a kind of futuristic summit every year. And I went to that and a lot of it was around that. The whole theme was customer experience. And they had done some research, which looked really good, actually. They basically more or less proved that people will pay more for a better experience. And there's actually significant financial benefit to having what they call a good experience. The other thing they noted, which I thought was really interesting, is that people are getting more demanding. So the incidence of dissatisfaction or what they call customer rage is going up, based on smaller and smaller stimuli. So we're getting much more picky than we used to be.
Or maybe we're just expecting to get what we pay
more.
For.
Yes,
expect more. I think we expect the basics because if you
maybe
ask me,
right.
I would
maybe
say
you're
that
right.
I think the rage is well placed and appropriate. For
we put up with a lot in the past.
You know.
Maybe you're right. Yeah.
Talk a little bit about sort of Salesforce here. So as you think about that end-to-end experience and, you know, the individual users, whereas your customers are big business, you're also very fixated on sort of what about consumer facing. Is this Gucci example of that? Do you have other examples of what it means to actually take a big enterprise and have it be customer facing too?
It's not a glamorous conversation usually because most customers will start with, you know, the end goal and they're like, all right, I need that. But really, these problems are solved much farther down the technology stack, and they actually go way down to the data layer. And I think that it's been a good thing. You know, the category of CDP is very complicated, and there's 146 of them and so on. But I think just in general, having companies focused around organizing their customer data has been very good. Mm-hmm. And marketing, you mentioned earlier, marketing is going to be big consumers of AI. I think that's definitely true. But the difficulty that marketing's always had is that they've had a more complex data story. And it's because they have more data, but they also have it in more different forms. And they've also had it in different applications. So they've had a plumbing issue, marketing, for years. And that's really what CDP was supposed to solve. And the issue is not, it's not marketers' faults. It was just what happened over time. They had to adapt to something which is very difficult to predict, which is customer behavior. I mean, we didn't know when the smartphone, like the iPhone appeared, that it would take off within a month, you know, and you'd have to have an iPhone app by October. No one knew, you know, we think we do now looking back, but at the time, nobody knew that would happen. So
we didn't know apps were going to be the center of our phone. Yeah.
No, and we didn't know that the iPhone would take off so quickly. And so consumer behavior, social networks, you know, back, I was remember the 90s, who would predict that, you know, we would share so much on these social networks? Nobody. So
nobody.
At any rate, that's the challenge. And then we had, because of SaaS software, you have an ability to get applications very quickly and easily. And so that's the issue. So I think over time, marketers recognize this challenge first, but now enterprises have woken up to it. And the fact that, you know, data management, data organization has such a outsized influence on the conversation wherever we go, and also on budget as well. The investment in things like data science, but also data storage, and now AI is just outrageous. I mean, it's very good investment, but it's become very significant. And so I think that's really where the conversation is starting. And it's getting more, you know, more important, more confusing as time goes on. But it's expanded beyond marketing, as I've said.
I want to ask a somewhat challenging question, perhaps.
Yeah.
When you think about the data and privacy, and you think about, you know, GDPR, California's legislation, more and more states passing it, how is it going to work with AI when someone says, I have the right to be deleted? But the model's already been trained on their transcripts from their, you know, meetings and so forth. How does that, I mean, it's so expensive to rerun the model and recalculate it. Is there a kind of fair use basis, or what are we going to do as an industry with that?
It's not an easy question to answer. And I think it's being worked out. It's not actually even being worked out in the courts now. It's being worked out sort of at the legislative level, the discussions are happening. So the question is a good one. These models are trained based on data. Presumably somebody owned the data. You know, New York Times is suing OpenAI because they said you used, you know, issues, past issues of the New York Times. OpenAI might say, well, it's fair use. And then New York Times comes back and say, well, if you use all of the New York Times, it's not really fair use, is it? And so I'm not an attorney. I don't know what the answer is. But from a Salesforce perspective, we're using these external models, so they're trained on whatever data they're trained on, and nobody really knows. You know, they know part of the data, but nobody knows exactly. Then when you train it on your own first-party data, you need to have consent, and you have a kind of a data lineage, like a trail. And there's also ways to aggregate the data, aggregate it up, and then add noise. So you can sort of do obfuscation so that when it's used to train the model, it's impossible to use that model in any way to identify exactly information related to a single data point. So you can't kind of back calculate down to an individual, even though you've used that individual's data to train the model. You know, you have a less accurate model, ultimately, because you're not using exactly the data that you use that you put into it. But on the other hand, it is more privacy safe. So there are ways to get around that. Companies are taking different stances. Some of them are saying, we'll just rerun the model. Some of them are saying we don't have a data deletion problem, so it'll be okay. Some of them are having very contained data sets. So they're, you know, data sets that they think are much less likely to be deleted and stuff like that. There's many roads to the rainbow. But you're right. I mean, consent and actually tracking that as metadata in the customer data model itself is really, really critical. I think a lot of the cookie, you know, discussion has been good for that, because before cookies, you know, cookie deletion in 2020 and GDPR, most of our customers weren't talking about data privacy in the US, maybe in Europe, but now it's basically all they talk about besides AI.
Well, it's interesting. We did a study with Syracuse University. We're just in the middle of analyzing it, but we asked the students how important their privacy was when we thought about AI. And I think it only got like to somewhat important.
Yeah.
It wasn't very important or extremely important. It didn't quite get not important at all, but it was just barely above not important at all. I mean, these are college students, and you know, I think that from it, there's a generational difference, but I was really surprised that it wasn't higher, because they just had an experience where they rated that the AI really got to know them really, really fast. So I would have thought that they would have been more concerned. But I think your point about data lineage is an important one for listeners to think about, because if you have transcripts from call centers and so forth, those are connected to an individual record. And if that person later on says, I want my data deleted, then presumably all the, you know, I think what you're doing of adding noise, so you're basically saying that isn't that person's record anymore. That is an amalgamation of other information. I think that's probably a good strategy. It'll be an interesting point to see if that gets litigated and where that lands.
Yeah, and I'm not so sure, too, that we don't know that you're not going to be able to figure out personally. I was a part of a Lucent technology spin out a number of years ago focused on deep packet inspection. And if you don't know what that is, that's actually the definition that the technologists foolishly came up with to describe basically sitting on the wire and seeing everything that was going through the pipes of an internet service provider. Terrible, terrible name, but nonetheless, it kind of says what
sounds
it is.
Like wiretapping.
Well, in fact, the biggest issue that we had in the company was making sure that we managed around wiretapping laws. Absolutely, Marty. But the issue was funny about that is that we were very easily able to determine who an individual was without having any records from them directly, because inevitably people type in their own name, they search for themselves on the internet. It was not hard to accumulate a massive understanding at an individual level. So I wonder if we're going to have that same issue here.
Well, from a consumer perspective, I think maybe we're more sophisticated, I would hope. But most people, they only notice privacy violation when it's obvious. And I think something like retargeted advertising makes it so clear. You're like, I just was on this website, now I'm somewhere totally different, and I'm seeing an ad for this product.
Yeah.
Someone's following me. You know, that freaks people out. But the idea of a model being trained on data that may be obscurely related to something, it's, I think, maybe less exciting for people. It's harder to figure out. Well, the other thing is that, you know, we're going into this world now where these large language models work, so not just on text, but, you know, in terms of segment discovery and all kinds of analytical uses, and they're generating great outputs. You're like, wow, this is a great segmentation scheme, but they're very hard to explain. Like, if you're trying to figure out how did it come up with this, it's getting harder and harder to do that just because it's so complex on the inside. It's sort of opaque. And so that's the world we're going into. I think we're going to have to trust them more.
Do you see a world where we don't have as many middle layers of management translating because the AI can do more of that, and or a world where we see some of these traditional silos between different functions in marketing becoming more fluid? Or, you know, describe where you think the world should be in the next 36 months or, you know, longer.
I mean, I try to be optimistic, and McKinsey's done a lot of studies around AI in the workforce and, you know, hiring for AI. And their prediction, I think, was that 30% of employee time in most big companies would be freed up by 2030. So there's two ways to look at that. One is, you know, 30% of my time I can do other things, more value add. The other way to look at it is I can get rid of 30% of my staff, because I'll be as efficient as I was before. So there's many, you know, I don't know which way it'll go, but I think it will depend very much on the company. There's going to be, we already see this friction being removed. I think just moving from in the marketing department, the email team and the web team and the social team being separate, working on the same, you know, customer data and the CDP has brought them together. And then it's already happening not a lot of places, but some places, marketing and the call center, marketing and service, are closer together than they used to be because they're calling out the same data and they can see visibly, you know, what has happened in the other side of the house. They can see what the marketers are doing and so on. So I think you're right. And then as this gets more and more automated, you know, the software itself will be doing a lot of those joins because the companies ultimately that have better CX, better customer experience, will do better. So they'll be the leaders. They'll have more money to invest. And so, you know, the ones who don't pull this off will either go out of business or they won't do as well, or they'll have to get their act together.
How much pressure? I know you guys had Einstein within Salesforce, but how much pressure, and I'm not sure pressure is the right word. Maybe it's direction. I don't know. Choose whatever you want. Is Salesforce getting to build more AI into the tools that you have? Because listen, I mean, we use Salesforce here at the MMA. It's a very cumbersome product, it feels like to me.
Oh, that's changing. Yeah. And there's two ways. I mean, I think of bringing AI into the product and then bringing the product to AI. So bringing the product to AI is, you know, letting people build models elsewhere and then run it on the data sitting in the product. But there's another way to bring AI to the product to make it work better. That's what the Copilot's supposed to do. Mm-hmm. But I think that we also have things like we built in a voice interface to the product. It's an early stage. Some of this is generally available. But basically now in the data cloud, for instance, I can describe a segment. I don't have to write SQL. I can just, you know, say, get me people who have this income level and live in this area and so on. And in the past, I would have had to write SQL code, which means I needed a certain level of skill and I needed to probably make a mistake. But the code itself can write that now in the background. And that makes the tool a lot more easy to use, but also it expands it to other users. So you can have the whole, you know, the whole team have access and make their own segments, do their own testing. It's rolling out slowly, but I think definitely very quickly, large language models will make most enterprise software easier to use. There's chat now and the Copilot, you can say something like pull my best lead, you know, give me a list of my best leads for the past year and then suggest a promotion strategy. And it will do that pretty quickly. So
when you said Copilot, I thought you were using that as a bit of a metaphor for Microsoft, who's kind of, I thought,
no, it's the same name. Yeah, you're right. It Microsoft, yeah. Copilot and then Salesforce Copilot.
Well, they should go back and start using Clippy again. I think that would
Clippy,
be
Clippy, yeah. Future, right? I remember Clippy. Yeah, it's the same idea, actually.
Everybody does.
They were ahead of their time.
Clippy was not helpful. Ahead of their time with something that didn't work. Well, and that's the fear with AI. I mean, you know, look, there are reports in Arizona where self-driving cars really were started or given permission earlier on of people shooting at them, running them off the road. In San Francisco, people are putting cones on the hoods of the Waymos because it can't drive through a cone, so it doesn't know what to do. And there was one set on fire recently. I mean, it's...
San Francisco, I heard, has gotten really hostile on the self-driving car I've ever had.
They really have. Come on, man.
That's the Luddites. It's sabotage, you know.
Well, I know. I see bias against AI, Rex. I think that's a problem we should go solve.
That is, somebody needs to stand up for the AI and maybe they'll remember that we did that for them.
It's going to protect the machines from themselves, right?
Well, I think Mark Andreessen is right here. He's like, you can't fight it. You know, you may want to stop it, but it's coming. So. But we, I mean, Salesforce is very much like all in on this. It's like, we think it's going to be great. You'd be crazy not to use it in a software product. And I think a lot of companies are that way.
So Marty, you have a lot of interest. You are a best-selling author like four times over. You know, I've always enjoyed reading your column because you always give me a different way of thinking about things. Your interesting story about the history of the cookie, which I was a very early user on at Wired. I think that was the reason why it didn't get patented by an ad agency, was because we had used it earlier enough at Wired that was what people used as prior art. You have your podcast, Paleo
Ad Tech,
where you were kind enough to have me on as a guest, where, I mean, just fascinating early history. When you think about how the history will be written, the way that your same thing that you're doing with Paleo Ad Tech for AI, what do you think are the most important innovations and moments that are happening right now? And what do you think is overhyped that we won't be talking about in 10 years from now?
I have some theories. One is on the generative side. So everyone's excited about writing and art. And I don't think real moving art pieces and great literature will be created by these models. I think people will always be better at that, even though they may use, you know, these models to a certain extent. So I don't think that's where the excitement will be. I also think there's going to be a lot of robots writing for robots. There's going to be a lot of like self-talk. What I mean by that is like SEO, for instance, you're creating content on a site to be read by a robot, you know, the Google search robot. So there's a lot of kind of, and in fact, you know, I could write a single line and then ask my model to turn it into an email. And then I send it over to someone and they have their model summarize it into a line. And so you have one line on one side. There's a lot of kind of noise in the system that I think is going to be ultimately useful, I suppose, for companies, but doesn't need people at all. There's definitely been a massive breakthrough here. I think it will be not a step change. It will be incremental, and it will just improve, hopefully, the way products work, and it'll improve, you know, consumer products and business products. It'll make the interface a lot more natural. So rather than coding, we'll be talking a lot. And this will be good. And I think that the negative side of it will be when they impersonate, when they pretend to be people. And there's a lot of danger there. We're easily fooled, I think, by fake people.
If you were to pick a dream, a vision, something for the future, like, you know, I'll tell you the question I get all the time. For mobile, for you mentioned iPhone earlier, right? So for iPhone, the killer app clearly was Uber and all that Uber represented. You know, I wanted to know what the car was. I wanted to be able to have timing on the thing. It was a representation of customer experience level we'd never seen and servicing and bringing industry together in a massive sort of, you know, in a massive marketplace. Do you have a sense where the killer app for AI is going to come from, what it might look like? What do you think it is?
I mean, the different phases of AI, there's the predictive, then there's generative, which is where we are now. And the next one is agents, sort of autonomous agents, I think. And okay. Then we'll get into okay. like general AI and like they're smarter than we are, which is coming, you know, not here yet, luckily. But the autonomous agent is where we're going. And I think that will be a killer app because we'll have I could have a virtual agent who's out looking for deals for me. You know, they know what I like because they know me really well. And so they'll eliminate a lot of the pain that I do, like shopping and looking for information, finding newsletters that I would really like to read. And so I think that maybe that will be it.
That's actually one of the startups for funding, and I'm hoping to make a virtual Greg Stewart next. I've even listed his daughter to help with some of the coding on that.
Actually, I think Rex was hired by my board to replace me. I think it's specifically what's going on here.
No, AI to represent you, not replace you. That's what we're aiming for with the Twin Z startup.
Oh, no. I've told the board that's my succession plan. Rex is building an agent for me. There we go.
That might work. Marty, closing thoughts here. Mm. Help us land this plane. What should the listeners be doing immediately as their next steps with AI to help advance their career so they do have a succession plan and AI doesn't replace them?
Well, I think it's always important to understand how things work. So I think it's well worth people's time not just to use models, but to actually look into, in a general sense, how they work, how they do what they do. And that makes people, like, for instance, I mentioned the data science class. I'm not a data scientist, but I have studied Python. And I feel much more comfortable when I'm talking to people about data science than I would have otherwise. So it's worth investing time and effort into slightly more technical sides of anything that you're doing. So I would recommend that.
Hey, Marty, we can't thank you enough for doing this. You really appreciate the time. You're obviously incredibly knowledgeable and well-versed in what the world's going to look like. So very helpful to listeners. Thank you.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it, guys.
That's it for this episode of Decoding AI for Marketing. I'm Greg Stewart.
I'm Rex Briggs. Be sure to catch all our episodes, plus subscribe, follow, rate, and review in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. You can get transcripts and more information on our website, decodingaiformarketing.com. And to learn more about the MMA and membership options, go to mmaglobal.com. Thanks for listening.